his bulging stomach, and regarded me with bland interest. "Ah, you're thinking that blackmail might work both ways, I suppose." He shook his head, dislodging a few grains of snuff that floated down onto the silk waistcoat. "No, my dear. For one thing, there is something of a difference in our stations. While rumour of that sort might affect my reception in some circles of society, that is not a matter of grave concern to me. While for the good captain, well, the army takes a very dim view of such unnatural predilections. The penalty is often death, in fact. No, not much comparison, really." He cocked his head to one side, so far as the multiple chins allowed. "But it is neither the promise of wealth nor the threat of exposure that binds John Randall to me," he said. The small, watery blue eyes gleamed in their orbits. "He serves me because I can give him what he desires." I eyed the corpulent frame with unconcealed disgust, making his grace shake with laughter. "No, not that," he said. "The captain's tastes are somewhat more refined than that, unlike my own."
"What then?"
"Punishment," he said softly. "But you know that, don't you? Or at least your husband does." I felt unclean simply from being near him, and rose to get away. The shards of the alabaster tobacco jar lay on the floor, and I kicked one inadvertently, so that it pinged off the wall, ricocheting and spinning off under the love seat, reminding me of the recent Danton. I wasn't at all sure that I wanted to discuss the subject of my aborted murder with him, but it seemed at the moment preferable to some alternatives.
"What did you want to kill me for?"
I asked abruptly, turning to face him. I glanced quickly over the collection of objects on a pie-crust table, looking for a suitable weapon of defence, just in case he still felt the urge. He didn't seem to. Instead, he bent laboriously over and picked up the teapot, miraculously unbroken, and set it upright on the restored tea-table. "It seemed expedient at the time," he said calmly. "I had learned that you and your husband were attempting to thwart a particular affair in which I had interested myself. I considered removing your husband instead, but it seemed too dangerous, what with his close relation to two of the greatest families in Scotland."
"Considered removing him?"
A light dawned, one of the many that were going off in my skull like fireworks. "Was it you who sent the seaman who attacked Jamie in Paris?" The Duke nodded in an off-hand manner. "That seemed the simplest method, if a bit crude. But then Dougal Mackenzie turned up in Paris, and I wondered whether, in fact, your husband was in fact working for the Stuarts. I became unsure where his interests lay." What I was wondering was just where the Duke's interests lay. This odd speech made it sound very much as though he was a secret Jacobite. And if so, he'd done a really masterly job of keeping his secrets. "And then," he went on, delicately placing the teapot's lid back in place, "there was your growing friendship with Louis of France. Even had your husband failed with the bankers, Louis could have supplied Charles Stuart with what he needed, provided you kept your pretty nose out of the affair." He frowned closely at the scone he was holding, flicked a couple of threads off it, then decided against eating it and tossed it onto the table. "Once it became clear what was really happening, I tried to lure your husband back to Scotland with the offer of a pardon. Very expensive, that was," he said reflectively. "And all for nothing, too. But then I recalled your husband's apparent devotion to you. Quite touching," he said, with a benevolent smile that I particularly disliked. "I suppose that your tragic demise might well distract him from the endeavour in which he was engaged, without provoking the sort of interest his own murder would have involved." Suddenly thinking of something, I turned to look at the harpsichord in the corner of the room. Several sheets of music adorned its rack, written in a fine, clear hand. £50,000 upon the occasion of your Highness's setting foot in Scotland, signed S. S, of course, for Sandringham. The Duke laughed in apparent delight. That was really very clever of you, my dear. It must have been you. I'd heard of your husband's unfortunate inability with music.
Actually, it wasn't, I replied, turning back from the piano.
The table at my side lacked anything useful in the way of letter openers or blunt objects, but I hastily picked up a vase and buried my face in the mass of hothouse flowers it held. I closed my eyes, feeling the brush of cool petals against my suddenly heated cheeks. I didn't dare look up, for fear my telltale face would give me away. For behind the Duke's shoulder, I had seen a round, leathery object, shaped like a pumpkin, framed by the green velvet draperies like one of the Duke's exotic art objects. I opened my eyes, peering cautiously through the petals, and the wide, snaggle-toothed mouth split in a grin like a jack-o'-lantern's. I was torn between terror and relief. I had been right, then, about the beggar near the gate. It was Hugh Monroe, an old companion from Jamie's days as a Highland outlaw. A one-time schoolmaster, he had been captured by the Turks at sea, disfigured by torture, and driven to beggary and poaching, professions he augmented by successful spying. I had heard he was an agent of the Highland army, but hadn't realized his activities had brought him so far south. How long had he been there, perched like a bird on the ivy outside the second-story window? I didn't dare try to communicate with him. It was all I could do to keep my eyes fixed on a point just above the Duke's shoulder, gazing with apparent indifference into space. The Duke was regarding me with interest.
Really? Not Gerstmann, surely? I shouldn't have thought he had a sufficiently devious mind. And you think I do? I'm flattered.
I kept my nose in the flowers, speaking distractedly into a peony. The figure outside released his grip on the ivy long enough to bring one hand up into view. Deprived of his tongue by his Saracen captors, Hugh Monroe's hands spoke for him. Staring intently at me, he pointed deliberately, first at me, then at himself, then off to one side. The broad hand tilted, and the first two fingers became a pair of running legs racing away to the east. A final wink, a clenched fist in salute, and he was gone. I relaxed, trembling slightly with reaction, and took a deep restorative breath. I sneezed and put the flowers down.
"So you're a Jacobite, are you?" I asked.
"Not necessarily," the Duke answered genially.
"The question is, my dear, are you?"
Completely unself-conscious, he took off his wig and scratched his fair, balding head before putting it back on.
"You tried to stop the effort to restore King James to his throne when you were in Paris. Failing at that, you and your husband appear now to be His Highness's most loyal supporters. Why?"
The small blue eyes showed nothing more than a mild interest, but it wasn't a mild interest that had tried to have me killed. Ever since finding out who my host was, I had been trying as hard as I could to remember what it was that Frank and the Reverend Mr. Wakefield had once said about him. Was he a Jacobite? So far as I could recall, the verdict of history, in the persons of Frank and the Reverend, was uncertain. So was I.
"I don't believe I'm going to tell you," I said slowly.
One blonde brow arched high. The Duke took a small enamelled box from his pocket and abstracted a pinch of the contents.
"Are you sure that's wise, my dear? Danton is still within call, you know."
"Danton wouldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole," I said bluntly.
"Neither would you, for that matter. Not," I added hastily, seeing his mouth open, "on that account. But if you want so badly to know which side I'm on, you aren't going to kill me before finding out now, are you?"
The Duke choked on his pinch of snuff and coughed heavily, thumping himself on the chest of his embroidered waistcoat. I drew myself up and stared coldly down my nose at him as he sneezed and spluttered.
"You're trying to frighten me into telling you things,
But it won't work, I said, with a lot more confidence than I felt. Sandringham dabbed gently at his streaming eyes with a handkerchief. At last he drew a deep breath and blew it out between plump, pursed lips as he stared at me.
"Very well, then," he said quite calmly. "I imagine my workmen have finished their alterations to your quarters by now. I shall summon a maid to take you to your room."
I must have gawped foolishly at him, for he smiled derisively as he hoisted himself out of his chair.
"To a point, you know, it doesn't matter," he said. "Whatever else you may be, or whatever information you may possess, you have one invaluable attribute as a house guest."
"And what's that?" I demanded. He paused, hand on the bell, and smiled.
"You're Red Jamie's wife," he said softly. "And he is fond of you, my dear, is he not?"
As prisons go, I had seen worse. The room measured perhaps 30 feet in each direction, and was furnished with a lavishness exceeded only by the sitting room downstairs. The canopied bed stood on a small dais, with baldachins of ostrich feathers sprouting from the corners of its damask drapes, and a pair of matching brocaded chairs squatted comfortably before a huge fireplace. The maidservant, who had accompanied me in, set down the basin and ewer she carried, and hurried to light the ready-laid fire. The footman laid his covered supper tray on the table by the door, then stood stolidly in the doorway, dishing any thoughts I might have had of trying a quick dash down the hall. Not that it would do me much good to try, I thought gloomily. I'd be hopelessly lost in the house after the first turn of the corridor. The bloody place was as big as Buckingham Palace. "I'm sure your Grace hopes as you'll be comfortable, ma'am," said the servant, curtsying prettily on her way out. "Oh, I'll bet he does," I said ungraciously. The door closed behind her with a depressingly solid thud, and the grating sound of the big key turning seemed to scrape away the last bit of insulation covering my raw nerves. Shivering in the chill of the vast room, I clutched my elbows and walked to the fire, where I subsided into one of the chairs. My impulse was to take advantage of the solitude to have a nice private little fit of hysterics. On the other hand, I was afraid that if I allowed my tight-reined emotions any play at all, I would never get them in check again. I closed my eyes tight and watched the red flicker of the firelight on my inner eyelids, willing myself to calmness. After all, I was in no danger for the moment, and Hugh Monroe was on his way to Jamie. Even if Jamie had lost my trail over the course of the week's travel, Hugh would find him and lead him right. Hugh knew every cotter and tinker, every farmhouse and manor within 4 parishes. A message from the speechless man would travel through the network of news and gossip as quickly as the wind-driven clouds passed over the mountains. If he had made it down from his lofty perch in the ivy and safely off the Duke's grounds without being apprehended, that was. "Don't be ridiculous," I said aloud. "The man's a professional poacher. Of course he's made it." The echo of my words against the ornate white plaster ceiling was somehow comforting. "And if so," I continued firmly, still talking to hear myself, "then Jamie will come." "Right," I thought suddenly. "And Sandringham's men will be waiting for him when he does." "You're Red Jamie's wife," the Duke had said. "My one invaluable attribute." I was bait. "I'm a salmon egg," I exclaimed, sitting up straight in my chair. The sheer indignity of the image summoned up a small but welcome spurt of rage that pushed the fear back a little way. I tried to fan the flames of anger by getting up and striding back and forth, thinking of new names to call the Duke the next time we met. I'd gotten as far in my composition as skulking pederast when a muffled shouting from outside distracted my attention. Pushing back the heavy velvet drapes from the window, I found that the Duke had been as good as his word. Stout wooden bars criss-crossed the window frame, latticed so closely together that I could scarcely thrust an arm between them. I could see, though, Dusk had fallen, and the shadows under the park trees were black as ink. The shouting was coming from there, matched by answering cries from the stables, where two or three figures suddenly appeared bearing lit torches. The small dark figures ran toward the wood, the fire of their pine torches streaming backward, flaring orange in the cold, damp wind. As they reached the edge of the park, a knot of vaguely human shapes became visible, tumbling onto the grass before the house. The ground was wet, and the force of their struggle left deep gashes of black in the winter-dead lawn. I stood on tiptoe, gripping the bars and pressing my head against the wood in an effort to see more. The light of the day had failed utterly, and by the torchlight I could distinguish no more than the occasional flailing limb in the riot below. It couldn't be Jamie, I told myself, trying to swallow the lump in my throat that was my heart. Not so soon. Not now. And not alone. Surely he wouldn't have come alone. For I could see by now that the fight centred on one man, now on his knees, no more than a hunched black shape under the fists and sticks of the Duke's gamekeepers and stable lads. Then the hunched figure sprawled flat, and the shouting died, though a few more blows were given for good measure before the small gang of servants stood back. A few words of conversation were exchanged, inaudible from my vantage point, and two of the men stooped and seized the figure beneath the arms. As they passed beneath my third-floor window on their way toward the back of the house, the torchlight illuminated a pair of dragging, sandal-shod feet and the tatters of a grimy smock. Not Jamie. One of the stable lads scampered alongside, triumphantly carrying a thick leather wallet on a strap. I was too far above to hear the clink of the tiny metal ornaments on the strap, but they glittered in the torchlight, and all the strength went from my arms in a rush of horror and despair. They were coins and buttons, the small metal objects, and gaberlunzies, the tiny lead seals that gave a beggar license to plead his poverty through a given parish. Hugh Monroe had four of them, a mark of favour for his trials at the hands of the Turk. Not Jamie, but Hugh. I was shaking so badly that my legs would hardly carry me, but I ran to the door and pounded on it with all my strength. "Let me out!" I shrieked. "I have to see the Duke. Let me out, I say!" There was no response to my continued yelling and pounding, and I dashed back to the window. The scene below was eminently peaceful now. A boy stood holding a torch for one of the gardeners who was kneeling at the edge of the lawn, tenderly replacing the divots of turf dug up by the fight. "Hoy!" I roared. Covered as they were by bars, I couldn't crank the casements outward. I ran across the room to fetch one of the heavy silver candlesticks, dashed back and smashed a pane of glass, heedless of the flying fragments. "Help! Ahoy down there! Tell the Duke I want to see him! Now! Help!" I thought one of the figures turned its head toward me, but neither made any motion toward the house, going on with their work as though no more than a nightbird's cry disturbed the darkness around them. Back to the door I ran, hammering and shouting, and back to the window, and back to the door again. I shouted, pleaded, and threatened until my throat was raw and hoarse, and beat upon the unyielding door until my fists were red and bruised, but no one came. I might have been alone in the great house for all I could hear. The silence in the hallway was as deep as that of the night outside, as silent as the grave. All check on my fear was gone, and I sank at last to my knees before the door, sobbing without restraint. I woke, chilled and stiff, with a throbbing headache, to feel something wide and solid shoving me across the floor. I came awake with a jerk as the opening edge of the heavy door pinched my thigh against the floor. "Ow!" I rolled clumsily, then scrabbled to my hands and knees, hair hanging in my face. "Claire! Oh, do be quiet, please! Darling, are you hurt?" With a rustle of starched lawn, Mary dropped to her knees beside me. Behind her, the door swung shut, and I heard the click of the lock above.
Yes. I mean, no. I'm all right, I said dazedly. But Hugh...
I clamped my lips shut and shook my head, trying to clear it.
What in bloody hell are you doing here, Mary?
I bribed the housekeeper to let me in, she whispered. Must you talk so loudly?
Doesn't matter much, I said, in a normal tone of voice. That door's so thick nothing short of a football match could be heard through it.
A what?
Never mind.
My mind was beginning to clear, though my eyes were sticky and swollen, and my head still throbbed like a drum. I pushed myself to my feet and staggered to the basin where I splashed cold water over my face.
You bribed the housekeeper, I said, wiping my face with a towel. But we're still locked in, aren't we? I heard the key turn.
Mary was pale in the dimness of the room. The candle had guttered out while I slept on the floor, and there was no light but the deep red glow of the fireplace embers. She bit her lip.
It was the best I could do. Mrs. Gibson was too afraid of the Duke to give me a key. All she would do was to agree to lock me in with you and let me out in the morning.
I thought you might like company, she added timidly.
Oh, I said. Well, thank you. It was a kind thought.
I took a new candle from the drawer and went to the fireplace to light it. The candlestick was clotted with wax from the burned-out candle. I tipped a small puddle of melted wax onto the tabletop and set the fresh candle in it, heedless of the damage to the Duke's intaglio.
Claire, Mary said, are you in trouble?
I bit my lip to prevent a hasty reply. After all, she was only 17, and her ignorance of politics was probably even more profound than her lack of knowledge of men had been.
Yes, I said. Rather a lot, I'm afraid.
My brain was starting to work again. Even if Mary wasn't equipped to be of much practical help in escaping, she might at least be able to provide me with information about her godfather and the doings of his household. "Did you hear the racket out by the wood earlier?" I asked. She shook her head. She was beginning to shiver. In such a large room the heat of the fire died away long before it reached the bed dais.
"No, but I heard one of the cookmaids saying the keepers had caught a poacher in the park. It's awfully cold. Can't we get into bed?"
She was already crawling across the coverlet, burrowing beneath the bolster for the edge of the sheet. Her bottom was round and neat, childlike under the white nightdress.
"That wasn't a poacher," I said. "Or rather it was, but it was also a friend.
He was on his way to find Jamie, to tell him I was here.
Do you know what happened after the keepers took him?"
Mary swung around, face a pale blur within the shadows of the bed hangings. Even in this light I could see that the dark eyes had grown huge.
"Oh, Claire, I'm so sorry."
"Well, so am I," I said impatiently. "Do you know where the poacher is, though?" If Hugh had been imprisoned somewhere accessible, like the stables, there was a bare chance that Mary might be able to release him somehow in the morning. The trembling of her lips, making her normal stutter seem comprehensible by comparison, should have warned me. But the words, once she got them out, struck through my heart, sharp and sudden as a thrown dirk.
"They hanged him," she said, "at the park gate."
It was some time before I was able to pay attention to my surroundings. The flood of shock, grief, fear, and shattered hope washed over me, swamping me utterly. I was dimly conscious of Mary's small hand timidly patting my shoulder and her voice offering handkerchiefs and drinks of water, but remained curled in a ball, not speaking, but shaking, and waiting for the relaxation of the wrenching despair that clenched my stomach like a fist. Finally, I exhausted the panic, if not myself, and opened my eyes blearily.
"I'll be all right," I said at last,
sitting up and wiping my nose inelegantly on my sleeve. I took the proffered towel and blotted my eyes with it. Mary hovered over me, looking concerned, and I reached out and squeezed her hand reassuringly.
"Really," I said, "I'm all right now, and I'm very glad you're here."
A thought struck me, and I dropped the towel, looking curiously at her.
"Come to think of it, why are you here?" I asked. "In this house, I mean."
She looked down, blushing, and picked at the coverlet.
"The Duke is my godfather, you know."
"Yes, so I gathered," I said. "Somehow I doubt that he merely wanted the pleasure of your company, though." She smiled a little at the remark.
No, but he, the Duke, I mean, he thinks he's found another husband for me."
The effort to get out husband left her red-faced.
"Papa brought me here to meet him."
I gathered from her demeanour that this wasn't news requiring immediate congratulations. "Do you know the man?"
"Only by name, it turned out.
A Mr. Isaacson, an importer of London. Too busy to travel all the way to Edinburgh to meet his intended, he had agreed to come to Belhurst, where the marriage would take place, all parties being agreeable." I picked up the silver-backed hairbrush from the bed-table and abstractedly began to tidy my hair. So, having failed to secure an alliance with the French nobility, the Duke was intending to sell his goddaughter to a wealthy Jew.
"I have a new trousseau," Mary said, trying to smile. 43 embroidered petticoats, 2 with gold thread."
She broke off, her lips pressed tight together, staring down sightlessly at her bare left hand. I put my own hand over it.
"Well,"
I tried to be encouraging, "perhaps he'll be a kind man."
"That's what I'm afraid of."
Avoiding my questioning look, she glanced down, twisting her hands together in her lap.
"They didn't tell Mr. Isaacson about Paris, and they say I mustn't either."
Her face crumpled miserably.
"He brought a horrible old woman to tell me how I must act on my wedding night, to pretend it's the first time. But I... Oh, Claire, how can I do it?" she wailed. "And Alex, I didn't tell him. I couldn't. I was such a coward. I didn't even say goodbye."
She threw herself into my arms, and I patted her back, losing a little of my own grief in the effort to comfort her. At length she grew calmer and sat up, hiccuping, to take a little water. "Are you going to go through with it?" I asked. She looked up at me, her lashes spiked and wet.
"I haven't any choice," she said simply.
"But..." I started, and then stopped, helpless. She was quite right. Young and female, with no resources and no man who could come to her rescue, there was simply nothing to do but to accede to her father's and godfather's wishes and marry the unknown Mr. Isaacson of London. Heavy-hearted, neither of us had any appetite for the food on the tray. We crawled under the covers to keep warm, and Mary, worn out with emotion, was sound asleep within minutes. No less exhausted, I found myself unable to sleep, grieving for Hugh, worried for Jamie, and curious about the Duke. The sheets were chilly, and my feet seemed like chunks of ice. Avoiding the more distressful things on my mind, I turned my thoughts to Sandringham. What was his place in this affair? To all appearances, the man was a Jacobite. He had, by his own admission, been willing to do murder, or pay for it, at least, in order to ensure that Charles got the backing he needed to launch his expedition to Scotland. And the evidence of the musical cipher made it all but certain that it was the Duke who had finally induced Charles to set sail in August with his promise of help. There were certainly men who took pains to conceal their Jacobite sympathies. Given the penalties for treason, it was hardly peculiar. And the Duke had a good deal more to lose than some, should he back a failing cause. Still, Sandringham hardly struck me as an enthusiastic supporter of the Stuart monarchy. Given his remarks about Danton, clearly he wouldn't be in sympathy with a Catholic ruler. And why wait so long to provide support when Charles was in desperate need of money now? And had been, in fact, ever since his arrival in Scotland. I could think of two conceivable reasons for the Duke's behaviour, neither particularly creditable to the gentleman, but both well within the bounds of his character. He could, in fact, be a Jacobite, willing to countenance an unpalatable Catholic king in return for the future benefits he might anticipate as chief backer of the restored Stuart monarchy. I could see that. Principle wasn't in the man's vocabulary, whereas self-interest clearly was a term he knew well. He might wish to wait until Charles reached England, in order that the money not be wasted before the Highland Army's final, crucial push to London. Anyone familiar with Charles Stuart could see the common sense in not entrusting him with too much money at once. Or, for that matter, he might have wished to ensure that the Stuarts did in fact have some substantial backing for their cause before becoming financially involved himself. After all, contributing to a rebellion is not the same thing as supporting an entire army single-handed. Contrariwise, I could see a much more sinister reason for the conditions of the Duke's offer. Making support conditional on the Jacobite army reaching English soil ensured that Charles would struggle on against the increasing opposition of his own leaders, dragging his reluctant, straggling army farther and farther south, away from the sheltering mountains in which they might find refuge. If the Duke could expect benefits from the Stuarts for help in restoring them, what might he expect from the Hanovers in return for luring Charles Stuart within their reach and betraying him and his followers into the hands of the English army? History hadn't been able to say what the Duke's true leanings had been. That struck me as odd. Surely he would have to reveal his true intent sooner or later. Of course, I mused, the old fox, Lord Lovat, had managed to play off both sides of the Jacobite rising last time, simultaneously ingratiating himself with the Hanovers and retaining the favour of the Stuarts. And Jamie had done it himself, for a time. Maybe it wasn't all that difficult to hide one's loyalties in the constantly shifting morass of royal politics. The chill was creeping up my feet, and I moved my legs restlessly, my skin seeming numb as I rubbed my calves together. Legs obviously generated much less friction than dry sticks. No perceptible warmth resulted from this activity. Lying sleepless, restless, and clammy, I suddenly became aware of a tiny rhythmic popping noise next to me. I turned my head, listening, then raised up on one elbow and peered incredulously at my companion. She was curled on her side, delicate skin flushed with sleep, so that she looked like a hothouse flower in full bloom, thumb tucked securely in the soft pink recesses of her mouth. Her lower lip moved as I watched, in the faintest of sucking motions. I wasn't sure whether to laugh or cry. In the end, I did neither, merely pulled the thumb gently free and laid the limp hand curled upon her bosom. I blew out the candle and cuddled close to Mary. Whether it was the innocence of that small gesture, with the far-off memories of trust and safety it provoked, the simple comfort of a warm body nearby, or only the exhaustion of fear and grief, my feet thawed, I relaxed at last and fell asleep. Wrapped in a warm cocoon of quilts, I slept deep and dreamlessly. It was all the greater shock, then, when I was jerked abruptly from the soft, quiet dark of oblivion. It was still dark, black as a coachman's hat, in fact, as the fire had gone out, but the surroundings were neither soft nor quiet. Something heavy had landed suddenly on the bed, striking my arm in the process, and was apparently in the process of murdering Mary. The bed heaved and the mattress tilted sharply under me, the bed frame shuddering with the force of the struggle taking place next to me. Agonized grunts and whispered threats came from close at hand, and a flailing hand, Mary's, I thought, struck me in the eye. I rolled hastily out of bed, tripping on the step of the dais and falling flat on the floor. The sounds of the struggle above me intensified with a horrible high-pitched squealing noise that I took to be Mary's best effort at a scream while being strangled. There was a sudden startled exclamation in a deep male voice, then a further convulsion of bedclothes, and the squealing stopped abruptly. Moving hastily, I found the flint box on the table and struck a light for the candle. Its wavering flame strengthened and rose, revealing what I had suspected from the sound of that vigorous Gallic expletive. Mary, invisible, save for a pair of wildly scrabbling hands, face smothered under a pillow, and body flattened by the prostrate form of my large and agitated husband, who, despite his advantage of size, appeared to have his hands well and truly full. Intent on subduing Mary, he hadn't glanced up at the newly lit candle, but went on trying to capture her hands while simultaneously holding the pillow over her face. Suppressing the urge to laugh hysterically at the spectacle, I instead set down the candle, leaned over the bed, and tapped him on the shoulder. "Jamie," I said.
"Jesus!"
He leapt like a salmon, springing off the bed and coming to rest on the floor in a crouch, dirk half-drawn. He saw me then, and sagged in relief, closing his eyes for an instant.
"Jesus, God, Sassenach! Never do that again, do you hear? Be quiet," he said briefly to Mary, who had escaped from the pillow and was now sitting bolt upright in bed, bug-eyed and spluttering.
"I didn't mean you harm. I thought you were my wife."
He strode purposefully round the bed, took me by both shoulders, and kissed me hard, as though to reassure himself that he'd got the right woman now. He had, and I kissed him back with considerable fervour, revelling in the scrape of his unshaven beard and the warm, pungent scent of him, damp linen and wool, with a strong hint of male sweat.
"Get dressed," he said, letting go. "The damn house is crawling with servants. It's like an ant's nest below."
"How did you get in here?"
I asked, looking around for my discarded gown. "Through the door, of course," he said impatiently. "Here."
He seized my gown from the back of a chair and tossed it at me. Sure enough, the massive door stood open, a great ring of keys protruding from the lock.
"But how?"
I began.
"Later,"
he said brusquely. He spotted Mary, out of bed and struggling into her nightrobe.
"Best get back in bed, lassie," he advised. "The floor's cooled."
"I'm coming with you."
The words were muffled by the folds of cloth, but her determination was evident as her head popped through the neck of the robe and emerged, tousled-haired and defiant.
"The hell you are," Jamie said.
He glared at her, and I noticed the fresh, raw scratches down his cheek. Seeing the quiver of her lips, though, he mastered his temper with an effort, and spoke reassuringly.
"Dinna mind, lassie. You'll have no trouble over it. I'll lock the door behind us, and you can tell everyone in the morning what's happened. No one shall hold you to blame."
Ignoring this, Mary thrust her feet hastily into her slippers and ran toward the door.
"Hey, where did you think you're going?"
Startled, Jamie swung around after her, but not soon enough to stop her reaching the door. She stood in the hallway just outside, poised like a deer.
"I'm going with you," she said fiercely. "If you don't take me, I shall run down the corridor screaming as loudly as I can. So there."
Jamie stared at her, his hair gleaming copper in the candlelight, and the blood rising in his face, obviously torn between the necessity for silence and the urge to kill her with his bare hands and damn the noise. Mary glared back, one hand holding up her skirts, ready to run. Now, dressed and shod, I poked him in the ribs, breaking his concentration.
"Take her,"
I said briefly.
"Let's go."
He gave me a look that was twin to the one he'd been giving Mary, but hesitated no more than a moment. With a short nod, he took my arm, and the three of us hurried out into the chill darkness of the corridor. The house was at once deathly still and full of noises. Boards squeaked loud beneath our feet, and our garments rustled like leaves in a gale. The walls seemed to breathe with the settlings of wood, and small, half-heard sounds beyond the corridor suggested the secretive burrowings of animals underground. And over all was the deep and frightening silence of a great dark house, sunk in a sleep that must not be broken. Mary's hand was tight on my arm as we crept down the hall behind Jamie. He moved like a shadow, hugging the wall, but quickly, for all his silence. As we passed one door, I heard the sound of soft footsteps on the other side. Jamie heard them too and flattened himself against the wall, motioning Mary and me ahead of him. The plaster of the wall was cold against the palms of my hands as I tried to press backward into it. The door opened cautiously, and a head in a puffy white mob cap poked out, peering down the hall in the direction away from us.
"Hello," it said in a whisper. "Is that you, Albert?"
A trickle of cold sweat ran down my spine. A housemaid, apparently expecting the visitation from the Duke's valet, who seemed to be keeping up the reputation of Frenchman. I didn't think she was going to consider an armed Highlander an adequate substitute for her absent lover. I could feel Jamie tense beside me, trying to overcome his scruples against striking a woman. Another instant, and she would turn, see him, and scream the house down. I stepped out from the wall.
No, I said apologetically. I'm afraid it's only me.
The maidservant started convulsively, and I took a swift step past, so that she was facing me, with Jamie still behind her.
Sorry to alarm you, I said, smiling cheerily. I couldn't sleep, you see. Thought I'd try a spot of hot milk. Tell me, am I headed right for the kitchens?
Eh?
The maid, a plump miss in her early 20s, gaped unbecomingly, exposing evidence of a distressing lack of concern for dental hygiene. Luckily, it wasn't the same maid who had seen me to my room. She might not realize that I was a prisoner, not a guest.
I'm a guest in the house, I said, driving the point home.
Counting on the principle that the best defense is a good offense, I stared accusingly at her.
Albert, eh? Does His Grace know that you are in the habit of entertaining men in your room at night? I demanded.
This seemed to hit a nerve, for the woman paled and dropped to her knees, clutching at my skirt. The prospect of exposure was so alarming that she didn't pause to ask exactly why a guest should be wandering about the halls in the wee hours of the morning, wearing not only gown and shoes, but a travelling cloak as well.
Oh, Mum, please, you won't say nothing to His Grace, will you? I can see you've a kind face, Mum. Surely you'd not want to see me dismissed from my place. Have pity on me, my lady. I've six brothers and sisters still at home, and I...
Now, now, I soothed, patting her on the shoulder. Don't worry about it. I won't tell the Duke. You just go back to your bed and... Talking in the sort of voice one uses with children and mental patients, I eased her, still volubly protesting her innocence, back into the small closet of a room. I shut the door on her and leaned against it for support. Jamie's face loomed up from the shadows before me, grinning. He said nothing, but patted me on the head in congratulation, before taking my arm and urging me down the hall once more. Mary was waiting under the window on the landing, her nightrobe glowing white in the moonlight that beamed momentarily through scudding clouds outside. A storm was gathering from the looks of it, and I wondered whether this would help or hinder our escape. Mary clutched at Jamie's plaid as he stepped onto the landing.
"Shh," she whispered. "Someone's coming."
Someone was. I could hear the faint thud of footsteps coming from below, and the pale wash of a candle lit the stairwell. Mary and I looked wildly about, but there was absolutely no place to hide. This was a back stair, meant for the servants' use, and the landings were simple squares of flooring, totally unrelieved by furniture or convenient hangings. Jamie sighed in resignation. Then, motioning me and Mary back into the hallway from which we had come, he drew his dirk and waited, poised in the shadowed corner of the landing. Mary's fingers clutched and twined with mine, squeezing tight in an agony of apprehension. Jamie had a pistol hanging from his belt, but plainly couldn't use it within the house. And a servant would realize that, making it useless for threat. It would have to be the knife, and my stomach quivered with pity for the hapless servant who was just about to come face to face with 15 stone of keyed-up Scott and the threat of black steel. I was taking stock of my apparel and thinking that I could spare one of my petticoats to be used for bindings when the bowed head of the candle-bearer came in sight. The dark hair was parted down the middle and slicked with a stinking sweet pomade that at once brought back the memory of a dark Paris street and the curve of thin, cruel lips beneath a mask. My gasp of recognition made Danton look up sharply, one step below the landing. The next instant he was grasped by the neck and flung against the wall of the landing with a force that sent the candlestick flying through the air. Mary had seen him too.
"That's him!"
she exclaimed, in her shock forgetting either to whisper or to stutter.
"The man in Paris!"
Jamie had the feebly struggling valet squashed against the wall, held by one muscled forearm pressed across his chest. The man's face, fading in and out as the light ebbed and flooded with the passing clouds, was ghastly pale. It grew paler in the next moment, as Jamie laid the edge of his blade against Danton's throat. I stepped onto the landing, not sure either what Jamie would do or what I wanted him to do. Danton let out a strangled moan when he saw me and made an abortive attempt to cross himself.
"La Dame Blanche," he whispered,
eyes starting in horror. Jamie moved with sudden violence, grasping the man's hair and jerking his head back so hard that it thumped against the panelling.
"Had I time, Morgarve, ye would die slow," he whispered.
And his voice lacked nothing in conviction, quiet as it was.
"Count it God's mercy, I have not."
He yanked Danton's head back even further so I could see the bobbing of his Adam's apple as he swallowed convulsively, his eyes fixed on me in fear.
"You call her Dame Blanche," Jamie said between his teeth. "I call her wife. Let her face be the last that ye see then."
The knife ripped across the man's throat with a violence that made Jamie grunt with the effort, and a dark sheet of blood sprayed over his shirt. The stench of sudden death filled the landing with a wheezing, gurgling sound from the crumpled heap on the floor that seemed to go on for a very long time. The sounds behind me brought me finally to my senses, Mary being violently sick in the hallway. My first coherent thought was that the servants were going to have the hell of a mess to clean up in the morning. My second was for Jamie, seen in a flash of the fleeting moon. His face was spattered and his hair matted with droplets of blood, and he was breathing heavily. He looked as though he might be going to be sick too. I turned toward Mary and saw, far beyond her down the hall, the crack of light behind an opening door. Someone was coming to investigate the noise. I grabbed the hem of her nightrobe, wiped it roughly across her mouth, and seized her by the arm, tugging her toward the landing.
"Come on," I said. "Let's get out of here."
Starting from his dazed contemplation of Danton's corpse, Jamie shook himself suddenly, and returning to his senses, turned to the stair. He seemed to know where we were going, leading us through the darkened corridors without hesitation. Mary stumbled along beside me, puffing, her breath loud as an engine in my ear. At the scullery door, Jamie came to a sudden halt and gave a low whistle. This was returned immediately, and the door swung open on a darkness inhabited by indistinct forms. One of these detached itself from the murk and hastened forward. A few muttered words were exchanged, and the man, whichever it was, reached for Mary and pulled her into the shadows. A cold draught told me that there was an open door somewhere ahead. Jamie's hand on my shoulder steered me through the obstacles of the darkened scullery and some smaller chamber that seemed to be a lumber room of some sort. I barked my shin against something, but bit back the exclamation of pain. Out in the free night at last, the wind seized my cloak and whirled it out in an exuberant balloon. After the nerve-stretching trek through the darkened house, I felt as though I might take wing and sail for the sky. The men around me seemed to share the mood of relief. There was a small outbreak of whispered remarks and muffled laughter, quickly shushed by Jamie. One at a time, the men flitted across the open space before the house, no more than shadows under the dancing moon. At my side, Jamie watched as they disappeared into the woods of the park.
"Where's Murtaugh?"
he muttered, as though to himself, frowning after the last of his men.
"Gone to look for Hugh, I suppose," he said, in answer to his own question. "D'ye ken where he might be, Sassenach?"
I swallowed, feeling the wind bite cold beneath my cloak, memory killing the sudden exhilaration of freedom. "Yes," I said, and told him the bad news as briefly as I could. His expression darkened under its mask of blood, and by the time I had finished, his face was hard as stone.
"Do you mean just to stand there all night?"
inquired a voice behind us.
"Or ought we to sound an alarm so they'll know where to look first?"
Jamie's expression lightened slightly as Murtaugh appeared from the shadows beside us, quiet as a wraith. He had a cloth-wrapped bundle under one arm.
A joint from the kitchens, I thought, seeing the blotch of dark blood on the cloth.
This impression was borne out by the large ham he had tucked beneath the other arm and the strings of sausages about his neck.
Jamie wrinkled his nose with a faint smile. "You smell like a butcher, man. Can you no go anywhere without thinking of your stomach?"
Murtaugh cocked his head to one side, taking in Jamie's blood-spattered appearance.
"Better to look like the butcher than his wares, lad," he said. "Shall we go?"
The trip through the park was dark and frightening. The trees were tall and widely spaced here, but there were saplings left to grow between them that changed abruptly into the menacing shapes of gamekeepers in the uncertain light. The clouds were gathering thicker, at least, and the full moon made fewer appearances, which was something to be grateful for. As we reached the far side of the park, it began to rain. Three men had been left with the horses. Mary was already mounted before one of Jamie's men. Plainly embarrassed by the necessity of riding astride, she kept tucking the folds of her nightrobe under her thighs in a vain attempt to hide the fact that she had legs. More experienced, but still cursing the heavy folds of my skirt, I plucked them up and set a foot in Jamie's offered hand, swinging aboard with a practised thump. The horse snorted at the impact and set his ears back.
"Sorry, Cully," I said without sympathy. "If you think that's bad, just wait till he gets back on."
Glancing around for the he in question, I found him under one of the trees, hand on the shoulder of a strange boy of about 14. "Who's that?" I asked, leaning over to attract the attention of Geordie Paul Fraser, who was busy tightening his girth next to me.
"He? Oh, him."
He glanced at the boy, then back at his reluctant girth, frowning.
"His name's Ewan Gibson, Hugh Munro's elder stepson. He was wee as da, seemingly, when the Duke's keepers came on him. The lad got a warm. We found him near the edge of the moor. He brought us here."
With a final unnecessary tug, he glared at the girth, as though daring it to say something, then looked up at me.
"D'ye ken where the lad's da is?" he asked abruptly.
I nodded, and the answer must have been plain in my face, for he turned to look at the boy. Jamie was holding the boy, hugged hard against his chest and patting his back. As we watched, he held the boy away from him, both hands on his shoulders, and said something, looking down intently into his face. I couldn't hear what it was, but after a moment the boy straightened himself and nodded. Jamie nodded as well, and with a final clap on the shoulder turned the lad toward one of the horses, where George McClure was already reaching down a hand to him. Jamie strode toward us, head down, and the end of his plaid fluttering free behind him, despite the cold wind and the spattering rain. Geordie spat on the ground.
"Poor bugger,"
he said, without specifying whom he meant, and swung into his own saddle. Near the southeast corner of the park we halted, the horses stamping and twitching, while two of the men disappeared back into the trees. It can't have been more than 20 minutes, but it seemed twice as long before they came back. The men rode double now, and the second horse bore a long, hunched shape bound across its saddle, wrapped in a Fraser plaid. The horses didn't like it. Mine jerked its head, nostrils flaring, as the horse bearing Hugh's corpse came alongside. Jamie yanked the rein and said something angrily in Gaelic, though, and the beast desisted. I could feel Jamie rise in the stirrups behind me, looking backward as though counting the remaining members of his band. Then his arm came around my waist, and we set off, on our way north. We rode all night, with only brief stops for rest. During one of these, sheltering under a horse chestnut tree, Jamie reached to embrace me, then suddenly stopped. "What is it?" I said, smiling. "Afraid to kiss your wife in front of your men?"
"No," he said, proving it.
Then stepped back, smiling.
"No, I was afraid for a moment you were going to scream and claw my face."
He dabbed gingerly at the marks Mary had left on his cheek. "Poor thing," I said, laughing. "Not the welcome you expected, was it?"
"Well, by that time, actually, it was," he said, grinning.
He had taken two sausages from one of Myrtle's strings and now handed me one. I couldn't remember when I had last eaten, but it must have been quite some time, for not even my fears of botulism kept the fatty, spiced meat from being delicious.
"What do you mean by that? You thought I wouldn't recognize you after only a week?"
He shook his head, still smiling, and swallowed the bite of sausage.
"Nay. It's only because when I got in the house to start, I kent where you were, more or less, because of the bars on your windows."
He arched one brow.
"From the looks of them, you must have made one hell of an impression on his Grace."
"I did," I said shortly, not wanting to think about the Duke. "Go on."
"Well,"
he said, taking another bite and shifting it expertly to his cheek while he talked,
"I kent the room, but I needed the key, didn't I?"
"Oh, yes," I said. "You were going to tell me about that." He chewed briefly and swallowed.
"I got it from the housekeeper, but not without trouble."
He rubbed himself tenderly a few inches below the belt.
"From appearances, I'd say the woman's been waked in her bed a few times before, and didna care for the experience."
"Oh, yes," I said, entertained by the mental picture this provoked. "Well, I dare say you came as rare and refreshing fruit to her."
"I doubt it extremely, Sassenach. She screeched like a banshee and kneed me in the stones, then came altogether too near to braining me with a candlestick while I was doubled up groaning."
"What did you do?"
"Thumped her a good one. I wasn't a feeling very chivalrous just at that moment, and tied her up with the strings to her nightcap. Then I put a towel in her mouth to put a stop to the things she was calling me, and searched her room till I found the keys."
"Good work," I said, something occurring to me. "But how did you know where the housekeeper slept?"
"I didn't," he said calmly. "The laundress told me, after I told her who I was, and threatened to gut her and roast her on a spit if she didn't tell me what I wanted to know."
He gave me a wry smile.
"Like I told you, Sassenach. Sometimes it's an advantage to be thought a barbarian. I reckon they've all heard of Red Jamie Fraser by now."
"Well, if they hadn't, they will," I said. I looked him over as well as I could in the dim light.
"What?
Didn't the laundress get a lick in?"
"She pulled my hair,"
he said reflectively.
"Took a clump out of it by the roots. I'll tell you, Sassenach, if ever I feel the need to change my manner of employment, I dinna think I'll take up attacking women. It's a bloody hard way to make a living."
It was beginning to sleet heavily near dawn, But we rode for some time before Ewan Gibson dragged his pony uncertainly to a stop, rose up clumsily in the stirrups to look around, then motioned up the hillside that rose to the left. Dark as it was impossible to ride the horses uphill. We had to descend to the ground and lead them.